Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Get down with you. Now, the prank of the year. And savage it is, too.
On closer inspection, a delight becomes a fright for the phone company.
I'm really disappointed about the whole thing.
Now look at this. Look carefully.
T-E-L-E-C-O-M, telecom, and S-U-X, sex.
Oh, yes.
Ain't nothing to work out.
Ain't nothing to know.
Ain't no way you can grow unless you let go.
Ain't nothing to work out. Kia ora. Welcome back to Prank of the Year. At this point, we're very close to the end of our formal investigation into the curious case of the Telecom Christmas card. Luke and I have spent literally years looking into this, but even now we're finding new rocks to peer under. We do have a conclusion to our story, but we've got one more stop to make first. Today, we wanted to bring you something a little different, a deeper dive into some of the interesting subjects that came up during our research. The people you hear from today are experts in their field, and during the course of our corridor, we picked their brains about specific aspects relating to our investigation. These interviews might not help solve our mystery, but we wanted to use this episode to amble down some of the investigative side streets and share what we found with you all. Our final episode will land in your feed on Friday the 22nd of December, the 30th anniversary of the Holmes broadcast that started this whole journey. Until then, I hope you'll find these tangents as fascinating as we did. If you think about it, this entire project wouldn't exist if Telecom's marketing team hadn't made the decision to spread seasonal cheer to its customers with a Christmas card in 1993. You might remember from our second episode that Telecom's marketing went through a bit of an overhaul in the 90s. Remember Spot? So how would a Christmas card feed into their overall marketing strategy?
I can't particularly remember this incident at the time, to be honest. I certainly grew up with memories of, discussions around Telecom being a monopoly. And, you know, there was a lot of public sentiment against Telecom at that time. But no, I don't remember this particular incident, but I did read the article that you sent me and had a look into it. But, you know, certainly during that time, we're a much less internet-based society, so something like a Christmas card was something that everybody did for each other. So it's an attempt to, I guess, show the customer that they're valued, that you're kind of engaged with their lives and that you're part of their life.
This is Dr. Phoebe Fletcher, a marketing lecturer at Massey University. While Phoebe wasn't involved in Telecom's marketing per se, I reached out to her because I wanted to dig into what the concept of marketing actually is and why a company like Telecom might devote time and resource to it.
So marketing is really closely aligned to the overall strategy of the company in that it's thinking about your broader objectives and how you create customer value. So that is thinking about the perception of the product in the mind of the consumer and how you kind of continue to generate customers, because if you don't have customers, then you often don't have a business because you're not generating revenue. So it's really thinking about a whole pile of core levers like product, price, place, promotion, people, processes, and physical evidence. And marketing actually covers a whole pile of areas that you wouldn't think it covers. So, you know, when you talk about things like people, for example, you know, like the people in your organization, they're part of your branding process as well, because every interaction they have with the consumers gets kind of perceived by consumers as being a part of that brand. Distributing those Christmas cards is high cost. And it's high reputational damage as well, potentially, if something goes wrong. And that's why you usually have multiple eyes that pour over that. So it's really highly unusual that anything actually got through. And it's hard to tell whether it was like a highly motivated individual or, you know, because it's got the logo there, I mean, maybe it's a form of sabotage advertising, which is, you know, where kind of a challenger brand will take on an established brand. I just think it's so unusual because there's usually so many levels of sign off. And when something goes wrong, it really usually is a result of people operating in a vacuum of marketing research. And I know myself from working in marketing that there's just such a plethora of ways that people think and relate to your brand. And, you know, sometimes you're just not aware of how people are consuming things. So that's usually the way that mistakes happen. So, you know, if you think about, you know, Coke Zero, they rebranded as Coke No Sugar because in the UK they found out that like a quarter of consumers didn't know that Coke Zero meant zero sugar. Or you think about, you know, that massive Pepsi ad with Kendall Jenner on the Black Lives Matter, where, you know, the ad went through multiple layers of sign-off. It would have cost millions of dollars, and then it gets released and causes outrage because, you know, it appears to be, like, capitalizing off what's kind of quite a serious movement. It appears to be trivializing it. And you didn't have anyone in that sign-off process that was doubting that this was a great thing to be released. So this happens all the time in marketing, even with really big brands, but it's usually a result of, you know, not doing enough pre-testing, not looking at focus groups, not understanding your particular target market or other groups that might respond to it. It's very unusual that you get an act of deliberate sabotage that's in a piece of creative itself. Just because there are so many processes in that campaign planning process to ensure that stuff like that doesn't happen. So the example that you've got is just so unusual.
Phoebe's description of this incident as a deliberate act of sabotage is certainly one way to describe the situation. But as we'll learn from this next interview, it's not the only way. Early on in the investigation, during one of my many trips to the Auckland Central Library, I stumbled on a book with a back cover blurb featuring two words that piqued my interest. Art and crime. Art crime.
Art crime.
What the hell is an art crime?
A criminally punishable act involving an artwork, including acts such as theft, vandalism, or forgery.
I didn't know, so I borrowed the book, read it, and then reached out to its author. Aside from being a writer, Penelope Jackson is an art historian and a curator. She's also a trustee in the New Zealand Art Crime Research Trust and a world-class expert in the subject. Could it be that our Christmas card story was an example of art crime, as Penelope defines it?
So, you know, when the Mona Lisa goes, you know, leaves the Louvre, somebody nicks that, that's huge. So that's big ticket. But, you know, there's absolutely the other end of the scale. And they're usually, you know, the emerging artist or the poor artist or the striving artist, you know. And in fact, my second book was inspired by what is a kind of a, what I would call a small ticket item stolen in Arrowtown that I think it was Alison Naylor, was that her name, had made. And it was a small exhibition at Arrowtown Art Gallery and Museum where they sold works. And you know, what the tourist who nicked it didn't realise was that the cameras, the CCTV, was linked straight to the police station and she was picked up the next day. So that was really great. But just because that was, you know, a fibre work, it wasn't the Mona Lisa, that doesn't make it, you know, an important crime. To me, that was an art crime. And it was very deliberate. You know, she was an absolute monk. She walked in, she looked around, there was no one watching her, and she just took it off, rolled it up, and popped it in her bag. Off she went. Certainly, I mean, the art crime exists at that level, yeah. I profiled three case studies of three art criminals, blokes, who all stole big ticket items, like huge art heists, and then their mothers protected them and became art criminals themselves. So one mother, who was a nurse, she didn't realize that her son was basically a right, you know, he was very light fingered. He was a waiter and he'd been stealing artworks and museum objects for years. When he was caught and the police were after him, she panicked and she actually threw a whole lot into the Rhine River. She also put old masters down the incinerator and things like that. So she became an art criminal, kind of a second generation, to protect her precious son. And then the other mother was the case, a British case, where the son was a forger. And he was kind of, he was a social recluse. He was really good. You know, he could whip up a, you know, a painting, you know, a constable or whatever in an hour. But it was his old mother who would get on the phone and she'd have some kind of cock and bull story to a museum that, oh, now my great uncle was an art dealer and he left me this for my 21st birthday and it's an original blah, blah, blah. And then, so she did all the networking. She set up the meeting and then she sent her husband, the forger's father, who was in a wheelchair, really old, sent him along. And everyone felt sorry for him and he had this little painting and they bought it. And actually it was the British Museum in the end who found them out. So there was a real cottage industry there, but mum was the main kind of one in protecting the son. The other cases that I profile in here are women who think they're doing good in terms of conservation. And I profile several examples in Spain of where they've decided to restore a sculpture at their local church. And of course, you know, the local church was probably built in the 8th century or something. And, you know, one of the sculptures was a wooden, you know, Madonna and child and things from the 14th century. And she painted it so, and it looked like, so it went from natural wood to looking like muddy Barbie dolls, you know, hideous. There's certainly the case in the second book here of Rose Dugdale, who was stole a whole lot of works to release Irish prisoners from British prisoners and get them back to Ireland. So that was a political case, yeah. And, you know, she had a PhD in economics and came from a very good family. In fact, she even stole from her own parents to help the, you know, the cause. So, you know, she was up in court against her father, which must have been very, very hard. So in terms of New Zealand, though, we haven't got, you know, too many cases, fortunately, but there are certainly, as I say, that, you know, cases there. And you wonder about this case that you're actually looking at, is it, was there, you know, some kind of, well, not political really, but it's kind of that whole monopoly of business as well. And the kind of on that cusp of change, is that, was that part of it? Yes.
The question Penelope's asking here is a fair one. We've established that what happened could be considered an art crime, but could it also be something else? From our steadfast anti-nuclear stance to the 1981 Springbok tour, Aotearoa has had a long and colourful history with protest. I wanted to speak to someone who is well-versed in the topic, and I found another author who could guide me through it. That's coming up after the break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Stephanie Gibson is a curator of New Zealand histories and cultures at Te Papa Tongarewa, the Museum of New Zealand. Along with her co-authors Puowai Carnes and Matariki Williams, Stephanie literally wrote the book on protest objects in New Zealand, Protest Tau Tohetohe, Objects of Resistance, Persistence and Defiance.
I think I just think New Zealand has a really interesting, vibrant, rich history of protest, and I think everybody's an activist at heart, really, because it's all in the choices you make every day, you know, the clothes you wear, who made your clothes, and the thoughtfulness that you put into how you live your life. A lot of that is actually activist thinking and the things you worry about, like climate change. And I just think it's really great if the museum can document what people create to express these concerns and these causes that they fight for or worry about. And I think Te Papa can play a really good role, and all museums can play a role in documenting. The obvious protest objects are banners in the street, at street marches, placards, posters, T-shirts with messaging, little badges with messaging and symbols. Those are sort of the more obvious things that you see. But then there's also subtle protest objects. It might actually be an artwork inside a gallery, which requires a lot to unpick to understand. It might be a message somebody is hidden in something. It might be something that's defaced. Somebody's damaged something in protest. That's actually quite a common strategy to sabotage and destroy an object. So it's huge. I mean, you've got protest right from the beginning. So I can only speak in terms of when Europeans started to settle in New Zealand, but you immediately had pushback from Māori, of course, as they sought to grapple with the terrible impacts of colonisation. It all happened very fast. New Zealand was flooded by migrants. It had a huge impact on Māori, as we well know, and they protested right from the beginning, and they used lots of different strategies, cutting down flagpoles, writing petitions, occupying their lands. Māori have been very active in activism and protest right from the beginning of European settlement. I actually think it has a huge impact. I mean, I don't know if there's actually much data out there telling you whether or not there's impact, but when you think about Ihu Matoa, the movement to save the land up there in South Auckland, we started seeing very colourful posters and stenciling around Wellington, and activists were very keen to get the message around the country. I think they were concerned that the issue might just sort of end in Auckland, but they needed to get that message socialised around the country. And they went to huge lengths to visualise the message throughout city streets. And I think they were really successful. I think people got familiar with the name of the location and then with the kaupapa of what was going on. So it's reinforced, of course, by media and news and opinion pieces. So I think it's just part of the building blocks of educating people, of trying to get people on side. I mean, the only thing I put in the book was when Ralph Hawtrey, the wonderful artist, he defaced a sign down at Aramoana. He just threw a can of paint over it because they were, you know, they wanted to build an aluminium smelter down at Aramoana in the 80s. So he defaced the smelter's sign, and I think it's quite sort of ironic. He's an artist who worked with paint, and he used paint to deface a public sign, and then that defaced sign was captured by a good friend of his who was a photographer, Gary Blackman, and he photographed the defaced sign, and then that photograph was considered art and went into an art collection. But it doesn't surprise me now that I've read the article and in the time that it was created, and I can see why somebody would have said that, because communities would have still been hurting in the early 90s with the loss of their services. And as you say, I mean, I'm not sure about the history, but that it was still a monopoly at that stage. So, you know, people couldn't express their outrage by shifting to another provider. So I think the original defacement is a protest action. You can also see it as, yeah, vandalism. You can call it many things: graffiti, vandalism, sabotage, bad behaviour. But I think also it can be seen as a protest object, and it depends on what your perspective is, and what lens you put on it. Some people might be horrified. I mean, obviously it is horrifying when an artist's work is damaged. It's a terrible thing. But, you know, I think the artist was very good-natured about it at the time. Before the advent of personal computers, printers were incredibly important to protest movements, and you had amazing collectives like the Wellington Media Collective who worked with activists to create posters and campaigns. So the Wellington Media Collective were in Wellington from the 70s to the 90s. They were a group of activists who knew how to print. They were artists, graphic designers, printers. They worked together as a collective, and they worked with activist organisations and unions to help them print their, or design and print their campaign collateral. But they could see a real need in the 70s for people to get their message out and get it out effectively in high quality productions. And people didn't have PCs, and very few people had a printing press at home. So collectives like that were really important.
This idea of a ragtag group of print industry folk banding together to support grassroots causes, that spoke to me. Luckily, Stephanie was good enough to put me in touch with somebody that was right at the coalface. Chris McBride is an artist and activist with a long history of art-based protest in Aotearoa, and a key figure in the aforementioned Wellington Media Collective. Chris has been on the front lines of several prominent protest movements over the past few decades, and he was happy to talk to me about some of them. Just quickly, I met up with Chris at a cafe that was a lot noisier than I'd anticipated. Apologies in advance for the less than perfect audio here.
Wellington Media Collective was a community-based activist, artist group that had facilities which provided people with ability to create and to print posters and little books and leaflets and so on. Wellington Media Collective started in 1978. And went through to 1988, over a 20-year period, to create work that reflected the people's vision. When we first started, we were all volunteers. We provided our service for free. The facilities were available for people to come in, and all they had to do was to pay for the cost of materials. The collective was responsible for a very vast amount of work in the working with women's groups, working with the anti-nuclear protest movement, with the anti-apartheid movement, trade unions mentioned before, and various community groups and various Māori activist groups as well. So there's probably some that I've left out there, but there's, you know, there was a vast range of people, individuals, organisations that we work with to provide them with the support to create and to get their message out. We did a lot of work with the trade unions and producing posters and placards as well, mass placards, so that was mass statement type of thing. We did a lot of work with the Cleaners Union, with the trade union movement, with the bus drivers, with the early education And when there were other mass type of activities going on. We would give support to creating leaflets and posters and as I said, the placards and doing just a mass one colour print and having people come in and have a workshop to put the placards to the wooden wooden holders and stakes and that sort of thing.
I've had a great time talking to all these experts about their areas of expertise and experience. As you can probably imagine, I've fallen into a number of rabbit holes as I've worked my way through this investigation. And some of these holes, they've taken a while for me to find my way out of. So thank you for being patient and for taking this little detour with me. And now that we've done some spelunking, let's find our way back to the surface. One of our reasons for reaching out to the people we've heard from today was to ask a specific question. Was the defacing of Grey Dixon's painting, and thus the Telecom Christmas card, an isolated incident? Or were there other comparable examples of corporate sabotage in Aotearoa? From a marketing perspective, Phoebe wasn't aware of too many, but she gave us a couple of global examples that sprung to mind.
There's only really a few examples that I can think of anything similar. One would be, I think I've discussed this with you before, the Homeland television series where they tried to basically create an authentic looking Arabic set, and they got a set designer in to write in Arabic, and they wrote Homeland is racist, and nobody noticed before it was released and it went out on television.
Penelope, our art crime expert, she mentioned a few times that public artworks had been damaged, but she couldn't pinpoint anything comparable to the Christmas card.
Of course, the big case, was it last year or the year before, was that guy who damaged the wind wand on Wellington Harbour. You know, he was being an idiot and being dared by his friends kind of thing. But that was, you know, a much loved work. So, you know, when there's a public artwork that is damaged, you know, there's an absolute outcry because people do love. I mean, you know, that's the reason that councils and philanthropists and things put works out there. But when they're vandalised, it's terrible. So that was a big one. And that was interesting because, you know, he was, you know, convicted and sentenced as well. So that was quite a recent one.
Along with her examples of the Save Our Post Office posters and the Ralph Hortery paint flinging incident, Stephanie mentioned how defaced government documents became a way to protest the war effort.
Well, I really like the things where people are really strategic about what's going to cause the most havoc. So, for example, the defaced registration forms for National Military Service in the early 70s. So until 1972, young men had to do military service. And they could snarl up the government bureaucracy by sending in bulk, like hundreds of thousands of defaced registration forms, which, you know, bureaucrats in Wellington had to still process in some way. So I like that kind of object, which just ends up getting hidden in government files, but it's still there. The government keeps all that stuff. They don't throw it out. And I find that absolutely fascinating.
And Chris filled us in on the co-opting of police imagery to make an anti-police statement.
The other one that I think is probably worth thinking about or talking about, which caused some controversy, was the Top Street Gang posters, but particularly the one that was done in 1981. Is this life for you? Join New Zealand's top street gang. It's a thug's life. So it depicts a cop with a long baton about to come down on the top of the head of a young Māori protester.
We also asked them the question that we've asked all of our interview subjects. If they were to speculate, what did they think happened in the case of the defaced Christmas card? Who might have done it? How? Where? And why?
You know, it's possible that this was something sneakily organised. It's really impossible to know whether it was an individual or someone that potentially had links to the company. But of course, the company would officially, Clear would officially deny that.
Was it an inside job? You know, did a employee who'd lost a job were thinking, oh yeah, a Merry Christmas like hell?
So it wouldn't surprise me if there were a few printers in big established printing firms that had an activist bent themselves and might have seized an opportunity to put a message in there.
If we're going to make sense of all this, we need to bring everything that we've learned over the last 5 years together. It's time to stare at all the thumbtacks and the red string on our corkboard, to review the evidence and to formulate some theories. It's time to lay everything on the line. This journey's been a long one. We've covered a lot of ground. We've heard "I don't remember" more times than I can count. But the end is in sight. I've got to believe that we're closer than anyone has ever been, and likely ever will be, to uncovering exactly what happened with the 1993 Telecom Christmas card. And that will be the focus of our next and final episode. Our series finale will be in your podcast feed from Friday the 22nd of December. And Luke and I both hope that you'll tune in and conclude this journey with us. Till then, ka kite anō.
If I knew that tomorrow would be the last day that I live.
On the next episode of Prank of the Year,
I believe that this sequence of events is the most comprehensive account of the telecom card incident that exists.
This is getting too dangerous for you. We're going home and you're going to keep out of the whole affair while you're in one piece.
Then I would gladly pass the painting on to them, and we might get something nice out of this event.
Prank of the Year is written and produced by Luke Watkinson and me, Craig Major. Thanks in this episode go to Dr. Phoebe Fletcher from Massey University, Penelope Jackson of the New Zealand Art Crime Research Trust, Stephanie Gibson from Te Papa Tongarewa, the Museum of New Zealand, and Chris McBride.
Our opening theme song is Let Go by Kong Fui. Closing music is Cliché by Deluxe Boy. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with others and consider leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. It really does help, and we appreciate it. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes.
Do you know anything about the defaced Telecom Christmas card? We'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us directly and anonymously by email at telecomsucks1993, or one word, at gmail.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.